Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 7.
Chapter 7, almost like a detailed map.
Yeah, exactly. A map of domestic life for the elite, anyway.
Right.
A real feel for what it was like inside those mansions, the Jia and Zhu households.
And we're doing this by following a character, Zhu Rui's wife. She's quite practical.
Very. And her errands take her all over the place, gives us this perfect snapshot moving from, you know, private illness to very public social duties.
Okay, so let's start with her visit to the East Court. She goes to see Xu Baochai.
Right.
And she finds out pretty quickly why Baochai has been staying in her room. She's sick. But it's not your average cold, is it?
No, not at all. Baochai explains she has this chronic condition, a kind of hot poison. Redo is the term.
Redo.
Something she says she's had literally since birth, from the womb. Mm-hmm. It flares up now and then.
And what's really interesting is how she talks about doctors.
Oh, totally. She just dismisses them. Says she's wasted a fortune, basically.
Yeah.
Uses the term silver money, Yinzi Quan.
Wasted it on cures that did nothing. So standard medicine. Useless for her.
Which immediately tells you something about how she, or maybe the author, positions her. She's exceptional. Too special for normal doctors.
Your illness is unique.
Exactly. So she needed a unique source for the cure. And she found one, apparently. This bald-headed monk, a Latu Hishang.
Ah, the recurring mysterious monk figure.
That's the one. And he gave her this equally unique, almost mystical remedy. He called it a heavenly formula, a Hai Shang Fang.
A heavenly formula. And it has a name, right? The cold fragrance pill.
With Shang Wan. Yes.
And when you actually hear the ingredients.
Wow.
It's less like medicine and more like some kind of intense ritual.
It absolutely is. Part medicine, part, I don't know, performance, part impossible quest.
So what goes into this cold fragrance pill?
Okay, get this. You need 12 liang, that's about 12 ounces of the stamens from 4 specific white flowers.
Specific white flowers.
And they're tied to the seasons. White peony for spring, white lotus for summer, white hibiscus for autumn, and white plum for winter. You have to collect them right when they bloom.
Okay, that already sounds difficult, coordinating all that.
But wait, there's more. That's just gathering them. You collect them over the year, then you have to dry them all together on the spring equinox of the next year.
The following year. Good grief.
Then you grind them up and mix them. It's this huge multi-year undertaking. Patience, timing.
Unbelievable. And that's just the flowers.
That's just the solid ingredients. Besides honey and sugar later, then you need the liquids. 12 kinane, that's a much smaller measure, like 12 mace of 4 specific waters.
Specific waters? What does that even mean?
It means water collected according to the solar calendar terms. Rainwater from the rainwater term, yushui.
Okay.
Dew collected during white dew, beilu. Frost scraped up during frost, desen shuangjiang.
Yeah.
And snow collected during minor snow, xiaxik.
You have got to be kidding me. Collecting dew and frost on specific dates.
Exactly. Imagine telling your servants, okay, team, today's frost descent. Go find 12 mace of frost.
It's just absurd. And Zhu Rui's wife, she hears all this. And what does she say?
Her reaction is perfect. She basically laughs and says, good heavens, this is enough to kill a person with trouble.
Yeah.
She says, even 10 years might not be enough to get all those coincidences. It grounds the whole thing. It is ridiculous.
So why make a cure so impossibly hard? Does it say something about Baochai?
I think it absolutely does. It elevates her, her illness, her cure. It links her to these grand cosmic cycles. It's a performance of her unique status, her destiny, maybe.
Is she even really sick? Or is the illness itself and this impossible cure just a way to mark her as special, different from everyone else?
That's a great question. It certainly functions that way in the narrative. The medicine is a status symbol. Only someone exceptional, worthy of a heavenly formula, could need or obtain such a thing.
The illness is her identity in a way.
You could say that. And the punchline is, Baochai says she did it. She actually managed to collect everything over a year or two.
She pulled it off, the flowers, the dew, the frost.
Apparently so. Shows incredible focus, doesn't it? Organization. Discipline.
So where is this miracle cure now? Locked in a vault?
No, it's buried under a pear blossom tree. Very poetic.
Naturally. And how does she take it?
When the illness acts up, she just describes it as a little cough and wheezing. She takes one pill, about the size of a longan fruit.
Okay.
And she washes it down with a decoction of yellow cypress wangbai. It's just such a detailed, peculiar picture. Defines her character, really.
It really does. It's hard to pivot from, you know, gathering dew based on solar terms to delivering party favors.
Right. But that's the world. The mystical rubs right up against the totally mundane logistics of running a massive household.
So next task for Zuru's wife.
Complete shift. Mm. Ansu gives her a job. Deliver a box of 12 gauze flowers. Chadoui dehors.
Gauze flowers. Fancy.
Very fancy. They're the absolute latest palace style.
Gongli?
Dongli tu distinction yangfa. Straight from the capital. High fashion.
Okay, so social obligation time. And the distribution, who gets what, that tells a story too, doesn't it?
Always. It maps out the current hierarchy, the relationships.
Oh, who gets them?
The three official granddaughters, Yingchen, Tanchen, and Yichen, they each get two pairs. Six flowers total.
Okay. The sisters.
Lin Daiyu, who's Baiyu's cousin and main companion, she only gets two stems.
Hmm. Only two for Daiyu. Interesting.
And Wang Xifeng Feng, the one really running the household day to day, she gets the most. Four stems.
Power recognizes power. And what about Bao Chai herself? Does she get any?
Ansu suggests leaving some, but Wang Madam cuts in and says Bao Chai never loves these flowers and powders. She refuses them.
Which reinforces that image we just talked about, right?
Hmm.
Cool. Composed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Above the fray. Detached from frivolous things like fashion, it's a deliberate contrast to the other girls.
Okay, so Zurui's wife is leaving Bao Chai's place, flowers in hand, and she bumps into another maid, Jin Zuan. Mm. Then the conversation takes another sharp turn from high fashion and status symbols to, well, something much darker. They talk about the servant girl who brought the flower box, Changling.
Right. Let's dig into this because it's important. Zurui's wife immediately checks with Jin Zuan, is this that girl?
Meaning?
The one Su Pan, Bao Chai's brother, bought near the capital. The purchase that involved, well, killing someone. A manslaughter case. Darren Mingguanxi.
Oh, wow. Okay, so the girl delivering these delicate, beautiful palace flowers.
Is herself a commodity acquired through violence?
Mm, yes.
They even comment on how pretty she is, comparing her to a well-known beauty, Rong Danana of the East Mansion.
It's jarring, the contrast.
It really is. You have the peak of luxury and refinement, the flowers being handled by someone who's a direct product of the family's, or at least Studiovine's, brutality and wealth.
And the real kicker comes when Zurui's wife tries to talk to Shangling directly.
Yeah, that's just heartbreaking. She asks her Shangling, whose original name was Yinglin, though Zurui's wife wouldn't know that she asks about her age, her parents, where she's from. You know, basic identity questions.
Trying to connect, maybe find a piece of her past.
Exactly. And Shangling just shakes her head, says, I don't remember.
Doesn't remember anything.
Nothing. Her past is gone, erased by the trauma and the sale. Mm-hmm. And the text specifically notes how sad this makes both Zurui's wife and Jin Zuan.
They feel it, even amidst their daily tasks.
For a moment, yes. They see the human cost right there. This beautiful young woman with no past serving them because of a murder.
It's such a stark moment, the casual nature of the errand, the beauty of the flowers, and this deep, dark tragedy embodied by the person carrying them. And it's just gossip on the way to the next delivery.
The system just rolls on.
Okay, let's follow Zurui's wife. Where does she go next with the remaining flowers? This also tells us something about the house itself.
Right, the geography is shifting. The narrator mentions that old Madame Jia, the matriarch, felt the granddaughters were getting too crowded.
Ah, household logistics again.
Exactly. So Yingchun, Tanchen, and Xichun have been moved. They're now in a smaller annex, a Sanjian Xiao Baosha, three rooms, basically behind Wang Madam's quarters.
And Li Wan, the widow, is supervising them there.
That's right. Only Baiyu and Daiyu are still in their original spots, so the house is constantly being reorganized.
And when Zurui's wife gets there, what are the sisters doing?
Well, she finds Yingchun and Tanchen together first. And they're playing Go, Weiqi.
Go, a strategic game, intellectual, social.
Very fitting for Tancheng especially. But Xichun isn't with them.
Where's Xichun?
She's off to the side talking with a visitor. A young novice nun named Zineng from the Watermoon Priory. Shui Yuan de Xiaoguzi.
A nun. Interesting contrast. Go players versus someone talking to a nun.
It really highlights their different paths, doesn't it? Even this early.
And Xichun's reaction to the flowers is something else.
It really is. She jokes. She says she was just telling Zinang that she plans to shave her head and become a nun tomorrow.
Wow.
And she asked, you know, if she does that, where would she even wear these fancy flowers?
It's played as a joke now, but knowing what happens later.
Exactly. It hits differently, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's deeply ironic, foreshadowing her eventual withdrawal from this whole world, the world these flowers represent.
She's already defining herself against it, even playfully.
Seems like it. And then immediately after this kind of spiritual foreshadowing joke, the conversation snaps right back to practical matters.
Money. Probably.
Money. They briefly discuss the temple's monthly allowance, the offering silver, Yuli Shangong Yinzi, a Apparently, it's managed by someone named Yu Shun.
So Jineng the nun is probably there because her master is sorting out the finances with the Jia household staff.
Most likely. It just grounds everything again. Even the nearby nunnery runs on the Jia family's schedule and their money, spirituality and administration side by side. Zhu Rui's wife, she passes Li Yuan's window, knows she's napping, which is, you know, a little status update in itself, who has leisure time.
Right. A quiet moment.
And then she heads for Wang Shifeng's quarters. And maybe we should clarify, we'll mostly call her Feng Ji, her nickname, the one that really signals her power.
Absolutely. Feng Ji. And when Zhu Rui's wife gets there, she has to wait. She hears Jia Lian's voice, laughter from inside.
Ah.
It signals, you know, privacy, maybe business, maybe something more personal. But it immediately tells you, Feng Ji's place is the hub. She's active, dealing with things, even behind closed doors.
So the first big errand that really unwraps this social web for us is the flower delivery. This is our errand of the palace flowers and cutting remarks.
Yeah, this is a classic.
Zhu Rui's wife has this gift from Aunt Xu, these artificial flowers, palace-made, piled gauze.
Sounds lovely, right?
Sounds nice, yeah. But instantly it becomes about status, about managing social debts. It's not just about the flowers.
So how does that play out?
Well, think about the chain of command here. Aunt Xu gives the box to Zhu Rui's wife. She then goes to Pinger, Feng Ji's chief maid. Indispensable.
The indispensable Pinger, who acts as Feng Ji's delegate, basically her operations manager. Pinger opens the box, takes out four, gives back two, and says, send these two to Qin Shi. That's Little Rong Grand Dam over in the Ning Mansion next door.
Wow. Okay, hold on. That's bureaucratic. For flowers.
Exactly.
This little gift needs careful handling across two huge households. And it's not even the main ladies doing it. It's their top agents, like Pinger.
The gift itself is almost irrelevant. It's the management of the delivery, the distribution, that shows the power structure.
Which takes us right to Lin Dayu, and maybe the most revealing moment of this whole sequence.
Mm-hmm. The famous confrontation.
Zhu Rui's wife brings the last two flowers to Dayu's place.
And Bayu, ever curious, grabs the box first.
Of course he does. But Dayu, she barely looks at them. Her first question is sharp. It's all about status. Were these only for me, or did other people get them too?
She cuts right to the chase.
Yeah.
And when Zhu Rui's wife confirms, yeah, everyone else got theirs first.
That's when she drops that line, that cold, cutting remark. I knew it. If they weren't someone else's leftovers, they wouldn't give them to me. Ouch.
Pure acid, just dripping with sarcasm.
But hang on. Is this constant testing, the sensitivity, is it smart? I mean, she's a guest, right? Dependent on their goodwill. Isn't being this difficult, maybe, I don't know, risky.
Well, it is risky, but it's also her survival strategy, you could argue. She's hyper aware of her position as an orphan, relying on the Jia family. Every little thing, every gift, every perceived slight, it's data for her.
Data about where she stands.
Exactly. So by saying that, she's signaling, I see the hierarchy, I noticed I was last, and I have pride, even if I don't have power. It's her refusing to just be an afterthought, even if she feels like one.
That makes sense. It's not just petulance. It's a statement.
It really sets the stage for her whole character arc, that sensitivity, that awareness.
Okay, so from that really high status, subtle social game, mm-hmm. We pivot hard. Zhu Rui's wife steps outside, and bam, reality hits. Her daughter intercepts her, totally distraught. The change in tone is just jarring.
It's night and day, isn't it? One minute, it's the etiquette of silk flowers. The next, it's a genuine crisis that could ruin a family.
And the daughter's husband, Cold Zixing, who we kind of know from his connection to Yukon.
Right, the opportunist.
He's in real trouble. Drank too much, got in a fight, accused of having unclear origins, and now he's facing banishment. The text says, Diji Huanxiang.
And that phrase, banishment back to your supposed native place for someone without powerful backing, that's catastrophic. Yeah. Social ruin, financial ruin, everything. Daughter's desperate for King Fan connection, someone to intervene. She's terrified.
Totally understandable. But Zhu Rui's wife, she almost shrugs it off, tells her daughter basically, calm down, you're overreacting. How can she be so cool about something that sounds like utter disaster for anyone else?
Because she knows exactly how the real system works.
Inside the compound walls.
Right. She tells her daughter, go home, I'll handle it. Her plan. Just mention it to Feng Ji later that evening, you know, after Feng Ji has unloaded her makeup, when things are maybe a bit more relaxed.
So her confidence isn't in the legal system, it's in her access.
Entirely.
Yeah.
It's built on the master's influence. She knows Feng Ji can likely make this go away with a word or two.
That's breathtaking, actually. the power these high-level servants wield. They can basically bypass the official justice system for their own family because they have the ear of someone like Feng Ji.
It shows you the massive gap, doesn't it? For Ziyu Rui's wife, a potential legal catastrophe is just an errand, a favor to call in.
The court system is irrelevant if you've got the right connections.
That's the power differential right there.
Okay, so we've established Feng Ji as this ultimate power broker. Let's move to Section 3 and actually see her in action. That evening, she's reporting to Mrs. Wang. And you said we should think of her like a CEO.
Absolutely. She's running a massive operation. This isn't just housekeeping. It's like managing a corporation.
So what's on her CEO report?
Well, finance, logistics. It's complex stuff. She confirms they received goods from the Zhen family, who are incredibly influential, remember?
Right, a big deal.
And she's already arranged to send return gifts back immediately using the Zhen family's own boat. That's efficient. Inventory, customs, diplomacy, all in one.
Plus, she's juggling social stuff, organizing the official gifts for some marquee's mother's birthday. Needs people to deliver them, managing all that.
Yeah, constant resource management. But the really interesting strategic bit is when Mrs. Wang talks about an invitation from Yu Shijiazhen's wife over at the Ning Mansion inviting Feng Ji to visit the next day. And Mrs. Wang points out, look, she invited you, Feng Ji, specifically, not me.
So it's personal.
Right. Mrs. Wang says, basically, that shows real affection. Don't slight her biegufu Le Ted Singh. Don't neglect that relationship.
So the matriarch, Mrs. Wang, is actively delegating this kind of high-level social networking to Feng Ji. She sees that Feng Ji's personal connections are vital to the whole family's standing.
Exactly. Feng Ji isn't just managing budgets. She's managing the family's social capital. Critically important work.
Which leads us perfectly into Section 4, the payoff of that visit to Ningfu. This is where we get the big introduction. Qin Zong.
Right. Feng Ji goes over with Bao Yu. They're greeted by Yu Shi and Qin Shi.
And Qin Shi, Bao Yu's nephew's wife, suggests Bao Yu should meet her younger brother, Qin Zong. He's nearby, studying.
But Feng Ji, even though she's clearly got a million things on her plate, she jumps in. Hold on, I want to see him first.
Oh, interesting. Why?
Well, Yu Shi immediately starts teasing her about it. Jokes that Qin Zong is maybe too refined, too elegant to see Wen Wen to meet a rough kid like Bao Yu, calling Bao Yu a Po Lu, like a disreputable type.
Okay, a bit of playful banter.
Yeah, testing her seriousness. And Feng Ji plays along but pushes back, tells Ji Rong, Qin Shi's husband, basically, stop messing around and bring him here or I'll smack you. Shows her usual impatience, but also her determination to see this boy.
She gets her way, of course. And the description of Qin Zong is really specific, almost arresting.
It is. He's thinner than Bao Yu, the text says, but somehow more elegant. Clear eyes, fine features, powder face, and crimson lips.
Very delicate image.
But the key detail, the thing that really stands out, is his manner. He's shy, almost timid, and has the manner of a daughter, Yo no Roji type.
And Feng Ji.
Yeah.
The ultimate pragmatist, the hard-nosed manager. What's her reaction?
She's charmed. Completely taken with him, pulls him closer, asks his age, what he's studying, genuine delight, which is kind of unusual for her in this sort of interaction.
Fascinating. And then Pinger steps in.
Yes, this is brilliant. Pinger, reading the room, seeing Feng Ji's reaction, and knowing the importance of the connection between Feng Ji and Qin Shi, acts immediately.
Without even being asked.
Exactly. Proactive. She quickly organizes a table gift, a bolt of nice fabric, and two small gold ingots shaped like Zhuangun Jidi, symbolizing success in the exams. It's generous, immediate, and unsolicited.
That says everything about how smoothly their operation runs, Feng Ji and Pinger, and how important this connection is seen to be instantly.
It seals the deal.
Bai Yu, he's highborn, right? Raised in this, like, gilded cage.
Very sheltered.
While Qin Zong comes from, as the text says, a humble, poor family, the King Han Zijia. But the moment they meet, there's this spark, this intense recognition.
And what's immediately fascinating is how these extremes, wealth and poverty, somehow create the very same feeling in both of them.
Which is
profound isolation. They're both miserable because of their social position, but for completely opposite reasons. It's quite something.
How does that work? How does wealth lead to the same misery as poverty here?
Well, take Bao Yu. When he meets Qin Zong, who he instantly sees as outstanding in character and looks,
right.
Bao Yu just plunges into this really intense self-loathing.
He feels unworthy.
Utterly unworthy of his own life, yeah. He looks at Xinzong and thinks he himself is like a mud pig and scabby dog. It's harsh.
Wow.
And this isn't, you know, false modesty. The text suggests it's deep psychological stress from his privilege. He regrets being born into nobility, the Humen Gongfu. He feels his status has actually poisoned him.
He uses those really graphic images too, doesn't he? Like his fancy clothes, the brocade gauze, or just wrapping a dead piece of wood.
Exactly. And the fine food and wine, just filling a dumb pit, he says.
So is this genuine, do you think, or just like teenage angst from someone with too much time on his hands?
I think the novel presents it as authentic pain. He feels like he's contaminating the very luxury he lives in. Now flip that. Look at Xinzong.
Yeah.
His perspective is all external. He sees Bao Yu's gold crown, the fancy clothes, the big entourage, and he gets it. He sees why everyone fawns over Bao Yu.
So Xinzong's isolation isn't psychological, it's structural. It's real barriers.
Precisely. He sees that huge gap between them. And he actually says that the words poverty, Pinju, are a massive restriction. A misfortune, even. It stops him from properly associating with someone like Bao Yu, someone he clearly admires.
He wants that association, but feels blocked by birth.
Right. So their shared unhappiness, Bayou's anxiety about his privilege, Xinzong's restriction from lack of it, that becomes the unexpected glue.
They connect over how the system has basically wronged them both, just in different ways.
And that's the genius of it. The rigid social structure makes them strangers on paper, but their emotional reaction to that structure, that makes them feel like kindred spirits almost instantly.
Okay, so here's where things get interesting. Yeah. They pivot so fast. They go from this deep philosophical angst to like practical planning. Our sources say it's maybe 10 sentences of conversation.
It's quick.
Is that just the text needing to move the plot, or does the speed tell us something?
Well, I think the speed might actually reflect how desperate they both are for genuine connection and maybe purpose, something their environment isn't giving them.
Ah, okay.
So once that bond clicks, they need to sort of solidify it, make it real.
And Xinzong gives them the practical reason. He explains his cooter died, his dad's sick, he's stuck just reviewing old stuff at home.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, crucially, that to really learn, he needs one or two bosom friends to discuss things with.
And Bayou, who conveniently is also idle because his tutor went home, he immediately sees the solution. He can use his family's resources here.
Right. The Ji family's private school. Yeah. The academy.
Yeah. It's set up for family members, relatives, and, importantly, those who can't afford their own tutors.
So it's a perfect way in for Xinzong.
Exactly. And it's a moment where Bayou uses his privilege not to show off, but actually for something constructive, to build this friendship and facilitate study.
And the motivations seem pretty sound, really. They can study together, stop wasting time, make their parents happy.
And get that joy of friendship they both seem to crave. It covers all the bases, practical and emotional.
And they commit right away. They agree to tell their elders that night, Bayou his grandmother, Xinzong his father. They want this sorted immediately. It feels very clean, very hopeful.
It is. It's this little bubble of pure intention, of aspiration.
Yeah.
But, and this is the key, it's happening inside this deeply, deeply flawed system.
Right. Because just as they're making these noble plans for studying together,
the whole foundation of the Jia household just cracks wide open.
It starts so simply. They need someone to walk Xinzong home because it's dark.
Mm.
But the servants mess up the assignment. They pick the absolute worst person for the job.
It's Zhao Da.
Zhao Da. Tell us about it. He says something else.
Oh, he's the family's living, breathing, drunken historical conscience. And he's basically untouchable.
Why? Why could he get away with being drunk and cursing everyone out?
Because his status isn't based on manners or current usefulness. It's rooted in, well, raw physical sacrifice for the family's founder.
The grandfather.
The grandfather, yeah, the Taiya. Our sources say Zhao Da saved his life on like 3 or 4 military campaigns, literally pulled him from a pile of corpses at one point.
Wow.
And there's more. He starved himself to feed the master, gave the master the only water while he drank, well, the text says horse urine.
So he literally bled for the family fortune they all now enjoy.
He is the fortune, in a way, or the brutal origin of it. And the current generation, Lord Jia, Jia Zen, they just avoid him. They treat him as if he were dead.
Easier than dealing with the debt they owe him or the inconvenient truths he represents.
Exactly. He's the walking, talking, shouting embodiment of the family's violent past beneath the luxurious present.
So when he starts cursing the steward, Lai Er, for giving him this menial task,
mm-hmm.
things escalate fast. Jia Rong, the young heir, confronts him.
And Zhao Da just swats him down, doesn't care about his rank. He basically yells, "Your ancestor risked his life to build this fortune, and you repay my kindness by bossing me around."
He's challenging the whole basis of Jia Rong's authority.
Completely. And then, fueled by the booze, and let's be honest, probably decades of resentment, he just lets loose. He starts shouting the family's dirtiest laundry in public.
This is the explosion, the truth bomb.
Yeah. He yells about general corruption for stealing dogs and flirting with hens, that kind of thing. But then he gets specific and nasty.
He screams about incest, right? Using that phrase, climbing on ashes, Pahui.
Yes. And he accuses family members of sleeping with their younger brothers-in-law, or another translation is raising younger uncles. It's scandalous stuff.
And he declares he knows everything and threatens violence. White knife goes in, red knife comes out. He's completely out of control, but maybe speaking the absolute truth.
And what happens next shows you everything about how this family operates. The speed and the method of the silencing are terrifying.
The servants panic. They call his words treasonous, like words without heaven or sun.
It's an immediate threat to the family's entire reputation, its face. So the goal isn't punishment or correction. It's instant absolute censorship.
They tackle him, bind him up. And the way they silence him.
It's brutal. They literally stuff his mouth full of dirt and horse dung to physically stop the accusations from getting out. Think about that. The filth he's exposing is literally used as the tool to shut him up.
The repression method perfectly mirrors the secrets being repressed. It's grotesque.
It is. There's no process, no hearing, just immediate visceral silencing using the foulest means available, because the truth he's speaking is considered just that dangerous, just that foul.
And Ba Yu sees all this. He's watching from the carriage with Wang Chifeng, Feng Ji.
Mm-hmm.
And he asks this perfectly innocent yet utterly dangerous question.
Yeah, he turns to Feng Ji and asks, "Sister, you heard him say climbing on ashes. What is climbing on ashes?" He's just curious.
And Feng Ji's reaction.
Immediate shutdown. A psychological warfare, basically. She doesn't just dismiss it. She calls Zhao Da's words the ravings of a drunkard, and then she directly threatens Ba Yu.
Threatens him?
Oh, yeah. She tells him flat out, "Pretend you didn't hear it, and if you ever ask about it again, I'll tell the mistress, or I'll have you beaten."
Wow. So she's enforcing the code of silence directly onto Ba Yu, the heir, the one person maybe who should know the truth about his family.
Absolutely. She's training him in the family's most important skill. Willful ignorance. Keep the secrets buried.
And then, as soon as Ba Yu quickly apologizes, scared, she pivots.
Instantly. Right back to the school plan. Oh, isn't it wonderful, Ba Yu and Xinzong will study together. That's the important thing now.
So the subject is just buried. Under threats and a quick change of topic, back to wholesome education.
The cover-up is total. The truth gets literally stuffed down with dung and then conversationally paved over with talk of friendship in school books. The lesson for Ba Yu couldn't be clearer.
Maintain the shiny surface. Focus on acceptable things like studying.
And never, ever dig into the rotten foundations that keep your comfortable life afloat.